man, about 2. I came in the summer. And then when I got a little older, I was a guide. I was all around in the woods. Then I started in guiding and working in lumber camps in the winter. Finally got up to be a scaler. And I carried that on several years. Then I went to the International Boundary Survey. They came through there, and I went to them, and I never went back to guiding lumber camps anymore. I worked on the International Boundary Survey until 1917, and then I went in the Army, World War I. In 1919, I worked one summer again for the International Boundary, and then I transferred over from them to the Coast Geodetic. I put in one summer in Utah, the Coast Geodetic, on a Lemlin body. And then in 1922, I came up here as a recon man for the Coast Geodetic and was here 4 years. Then they left the country for good. They left it until about 1941, and they came back to do some work for the Army, and they was gone a long time, and I went down and worked in Minnesota for them, and New Orleans, down Barataria Bay. I didn't like that country down there, and I wanted to get back to Alaska, so I resigned that job and came back up here and went to work with the Fish and Wildlife, the old Alaska Game Commission. And they had a terrific transportation problem, and it cost them a lot of money, and they never got anywhere with it. Both dog teams of poorest transportation in the world ever devised, I guess. So I got interested in airplanes. I had seen airplanes in World War I and been shot at by them and seen them shot down, stuff like that. But Noel was flying here then. He started flying here in 1924, Norwegian, and I see him getting across the country, and I think I better be doing that too. So I bought myself an airplane in 1929. I was stationed here in Fairbanks at that time, and I got Noel to teach me to fly. And that was the first one I got was a blonde, powered Golden Eagle, they called it. It was a parasol type monoplane, and it was very much unsuited for this country.
What kind of
car? With blonde engine.
Blonde.
They're a tool company. They make engines their own too. So I sold that thing. It cost me $3,500. I sold it for $500 and bought a Swallow with a Kenner. It was an old cockpit. It was an old cockpit in those days. And that got me around the country. That was a good airplane for what I wanted. And that got me around the country. And I got the airplane patrol started. And I carried on for 5 or 6 years. And it didn't seem to got some unheard of results with it, because at that time, the people who lived in the woods committed atrocities on the game. Some of them did. They didn't know how to defend themselves from an airplane, but they used to be there so fast. And then I dug out aliens that were in the country, and a lot of them were illegally here, and they were pretty bad on the floor in the game, too. But it didn't seem to go over very good for the Game Commission. They didn't take to it, so after a while I got discouraged. So I laid off the flying a little bit for them. I kept on flying, but I didn't fly patrols for 1 year. And then, of course, there was the ceiling of beaver and everything, and all the fur buyers traveled by airplane, and they couldn't buy the beaver until they'd been sealed. They'd go down the river and there'd be lots of beaver to buy, but they hadn't been sealed, so they put up an awful hell. And they made such a fuss at the Game Commission then and got interested again. Well, they chartered a few times and I flew the plane and did the work, and then my own plane I sold because it was too expensive to maintain on a government salary. kept the game violations down, because people knew I could get there in a hurry, and they knew I could show up unannounced any old time, any old place, you know, especially in the winter. So it protected the game pretty good down the fur, and the fur was quite a factor in those days. In fact, it was one of the lifebloods of the country, you know. Well, after they bought a plane, we had pretty good luck with it, and then they got some other pilots and one more plane. And then I got a little bit discouraged. There wasn't enough flying, and they didn't have enough money to do much flying with, and I got a little bit discouraged. Then a little jealousy commenced to crop up over the airplanes, you know, so I decided to quit. So I did quit. And I didn't lose a day. I went back to work for Wings, you know. I went right away quick, you know. I went to work for them, and still getting a small government salary. I got a much better pilot salary. Well, I made out all right flying for them, and right about that time, World War II started, and Coast-Geodetic Survey come back, and they try airplane in their survey, what, for the first time, float planes. So they wanted me to do it because I knew that I understood their work very well, you know, having done it for them. And I was working for Wien, so Wien got the contract, first contract. And the airplane turned out to be very effective in their work, much more than they expected they would. Well, that went on for a couple of summers, and then the Army Air Corps came up here. They found that the map of Alaska practically didn't exist, and their pilots were trained for a different kind of flyer than the one up here. We didn't have the radio aids then up here, very few of them, you know, just a few range stations was all we had.
That now?
I was about 41. So, they put on a crash program of shooting in the stars. Send up pilots shooting the stars. Well, of course, the bright daylight in the summer, they couldn't get the stars. So that had to be done in the fall and winter. And usually terminated long sometime in April because too much daylight again. I mean, pretty rugged going. Well, they sent up a party, and of course, they got my name from the Coast Geodetic Survey. So they wanted me for the pilot, and I was still flying the wings, so the wings got them contracts. Them were good contracts. But they had pictures that was taken from an altitude of 20,000 feet by big planes. And no names on them, just a number. They were very secret, top secret stuff, you know. And a little more so than necessary, way it looked to me, but... Then they had a number on them that identified them if somebody had the key to a spot on the map. Well, then they had looked over the maps, you know, and they had seen a place like Chandler up here on Cairo, and they figured it was a town there in hotels. Tatlowit took down the Kuskokwim, and any number of places, you know, where there was nothing. Had been a trapper's cabin once, or mining outfit sometime, or they were all abandoned, you know, and lots of them were just trapper's cabins. So they come up here and got hold of me, and I found out that they thought their town was all over the place, and they were going to stay in hotels and road houses, and so I had a disillusioned item. We had to take tents. So there was a soldier, officer, and enlisted man, usually in each party, and the first party went out for two or three, but enlisted man, but they didn't need them. One officer and one enlisted man, the pilot could do it. So what they used was this one was a pool of mercury in it, you know, and the star, they'd have to make out a star list the night before they worked. And if the stars come right into that pool and they get them, they had to have good nights for it, and it had to be less than 35 below. And the mercury froze beyond that down. Mercury was supposed to freeze at 40, but we found that they froze at 35, but you couldn't use them. So, then when they found they're going to have a Templar, they figured they would rather go to Japan and get shot at or something. Because, you know, the cold weather got them scared stiff. But I finally convinced them you could live comfortable in a tent with a Yukon stove. That's the way we did it. We take a Yukon stove, 3 or 4 weeks it up with us, and go out in the woods and disappear. We couldn't use the radios. That was forbidden, and only in case of acute emergency, you know. Everybody was so busy, nobody was going to hunt for you anyway. It was up to us to be very careful. And we never got into any great amount of trouble. When I landed in these places where they wanted this spot on the ground, you know, located by the stars, the first thing I trained them so they could pitch a tent, put on a bed of boughs or a floor, you know. But I never could teach them to set up the stove properly. They couldn't get on to that. And while they were doing that, first thing I did was take care of the airplane. And then after I got the airplane taken care of the night for a quick departure, the next day, or whenever we got the stars, then we could go, you see. But the trouble we had was that the map, they couldn't get a good position from the map. So some of the nights they'd miss the stars altogether. They wouldn't come into the pool and they couldn't make up another star list until I'd given them an assumed position. And of course sometimes an assumed position didn't work out just right. But usually when I give them an assumed position, they'd hit the stars right on the minute. Well, it took them a while to find that out. And then one or two of them was kind of stubborn and they didn't want to find it out. They didn't want to believe it, you know. One of the best examples of that was Bettles. We stayed in the old town of Bettles. There was no new town there then. And they were going to Chandler Lake. Well, that was 35 miles off, east and west, and 15 miles off, north and south. That's where the map showed it. And it pulled out and showed the map showed it going out the Gillick River. And it didn't do that at all. It had a river on its own. So they made up the star list that night in Bettles, and I told them it wouldn't be any good. Been allowed for that 35 east and west, and 15 north and south, and did into it. Well, I flew in a load of stove oil, and then I flew the equipment up there, and then I come back to the men, the grocers, and there's no food, no wood there, you know. There's absolutely nothing in vegetation except here and there a blade of grass and moss, and the wind blows. Pretty big lake. Got up there and pitched this tent. We had quite a time getting it picked up good during the wind, but it was a good night that night. They could have got it, but their star list was no good. The stars didn't show up. So then we had 9 days straight of blizzard and clouds, and we couldn't do nothing, so we had to sit right there by the lake. And it was pretty gruesome, too. We had plenty of stove oil. Then I gave them their assumed position, and they made up another star list. And the next good night, they got the stars rolled right in right on the minute. They got it. Well, we went all over the country, down the Kuskokwim, the Yukon, the Kakuk, Chandler, and all over, and the Arctic Slope, too. Putting in them star points so that their men, the Air Force men, could navigate. And they finally got it, so across the country, and of course the men got more experience as they went along too. But that took quite a little while to do that. We got caught at Arctic Village one time, that is a little east of Arctic Village in 60 below weather. And they couldn't work, and we happened to have an officer at that time with us who was from Texas, and just as afraid of that cold weather as he was of a grizzly bear. Started in at the old Crow, where the old Crow crosses the border. There was wanted to get. He wanted to station this star station right close to that and they get. Well, we got it right. But they doubted my ability to find that monument. Of course, it was 2 feet of snow, but I knew what the monument looked like, having went to the national boundary. And I knew right where the old crow crossed the water, too. So when we got over there, I showed them the monument from the air, and they couldn't believe it. We landed on a lake about 300-400 yards from the monument, and they weren't satisfied, and they went over there and checked the number on that monument. And they were half an ocean, because there was an old stump, too, sticking out. They were satisfied at last. The timber was thin there. It wasn't much timber. We pitched camp there. It was 32 below that night, but they knocked the stars out, and then we worked our way west, landing every 25 miles, 25 to 40 miles, putting in star shots, Husky Lake. And then we finally got over to Arctic Village, and there's where it got so cold. The tent got all frosted inside, you know, except right over the stove. That was the old place that was melted off. They got pretty discouraged there, but they could have handled it better, but they came up here with a fixed determination to work a certain area just the minute they got here. And that was the coal belt. They could have been working down in the Kuskokwim or the Lower Yukon at that time, getting along fine, but they went right up there into the coal belt, where the days were the shortest and coldest, you know. I had the takeoff for the next station times so to get the best light, and they never did get any good light, you know. And I had them pinned down to within 5 minutes, and if they missed getting that tent down and into the plane by 10 minutes from the outside, then we didn't go that day. And one day we didn't go, but they were a little bit laggard about fooling around, you know. Pitched the tent again, we stayed there that night. The next morning they were on the ball. Of course, I was slap up in the engine getting it ready. Well, from that I went to ...1944, I went on my own. And I had Coast League contacts. I was on my own. I was on my own from 1915. I had Coast League contacts, Air Force contacts, Geological Survey contractor.
You map the biggest
share
of this country,
didn't you? Oh, yeah. That's my business in this country, was to map this. Ever since I've been here, you know, except, well, up until just a few years ago. 1955 was my last summer. Well, then the CAB, they badgered the life out of us, Bush pilots had independence, you know, and we had to hire lawyers. And then we had to have some accountant do office work, you know. CAB demanded reports. Finally cost us so much, and then people from the outside got to bidding on these contracts, and they bid them way down cheap. And I got them 3 years after that, after they started bidding cheap on the outside. The succession, I could always get my price, but a succession of those pilots from the outside come up here and they went broke, you know. They didn't bid enough, and they didn't know what they were up against. And they went broke, and things didn't go. Most of them went broke. I know there might have been a few of them made out. Then I quit bidding. I got disgusted, and I quit bidding. And then I wound up a couple of years flying the contracts anyhow. Somebody else would get the contract, and they'd hire me. Fly them. One of the best summers I had was flying for Bob Monroe. He put a blanket on the job, and he didn't have a pilot for it, because he wanted to send up on the Arctic coast. So I went up and flew it for him. We had just a verbal agreement. And by golly, he stood by that just as good. You know, I'd like to business with him some more, but these verbal agreements I find nowadays, they ain't so good. You go back on them, you know. Well, Bob Monroe, he was right there on the ball. Got some of it, and I know I forgot some of the agreement, but I know anyway, he settled up and panned out fine. I got in a pretty big summer that summer. operating 9 foot 8 mile an hour a day when the weather was good. Some days when the weather's bad, I'd only get in an hour or two. Some few days up there, I'd get in any time. Nobody else did either when it was. The Arctic Coast is a miserable place of weather, you know. Well, then from there, after that was over, I came home and sat down. I was 55. And I was going to take some rest. And then we come along and go back and look for them. So I've been flying to them since. This is my team. I was somewhere. I've been flying from now since 1955, second time. But we all, Wheaton boy and I, we always get along fine together. They never bother me a bit, and they only live up to their agreements, you know. They pay good money, too. And I'm on my own out there. You know, they don't send me no instructions or orders or anything. They know I know what to do. They just get stuff out there, and I distribute it. The Geological Survey had a party going to the Kobuk, and they got money enough to charter a plane for the entire summer, you know, to stay right with them. And it was a man and wife team for botanists and two young fellows for geologists. And the Kobuk is one of the most beautiful valleys in Alaska, you know. It's kind of open, and there's timber over there, too, with right along the rivers. So they didn't have the slightest idea what could be done with the airplane, how to organize it, so I sized the situation up, so I started making suggestions. So I would take, in the morning, I would put the botanists out where they wanted to gather their dry hay, you know, and leaves and stuff, chaff. Then I'd come back to camp, pick up the geologists, put them out where they wanted to go, and then I'd go back and if the geologists, the botanists were all done, I'd take them over to another lake. Another place on the river, wherever it was. And sometimes I'd move the, both parties 2 or 3 times a day, you know. And they were amazed at the work they could get done. They were very enthusiastic about it, and that was one of the best little contracts I ever had. But they were ill-equipped. They didn't know what to buy, you know. And the woman, she, of course, wanted to do the cooking, you know, which was logical, too. She was pretty good at it, but they were cooking for 5 hours on on 2 primer stoves, single burners. So I suggested that get a Yukon stove. Well, they didn't have money enough to buy it, but it was on the government account. Well, I got Yukon stoves and caches all around. I'll just go pick up one of them. No, they didn't exactly go with that either. But anyway, I had to come in for $100 and I didn't say nothing. When I went back, I took back 2 Yukon stoves, one with an oven in it, and one of my tents without an oven in it. And then we started living. The tents were dry, and the clothes were dry, and the tents were warm, you know. And the lady got so enthusiastic over this Yukon stove when she found she could bake stuff in that oven. And we had pies and cakes and roasts and everything else, you know. She was real good at it. Then one day, they thought they had me. We had to go up on the Maniwak, the lake up there where there wasn't any timber. And they was kind of seeing what was going to happen about that, too. See, no use taking stoves up there. And I said, oh, yeah, we'll take stoves up there, sure. So we took them up. And when we got the camp pitched and everything, there was no wood for stoves. So I got one of the geologists to come down to the river with me. There was a lot of dry wood, took a saw and an axe. Split up a nice little wood pile there, and every time I'd go back and forth, I'd haul in a load of wood in the airplane, and there's a load of wood up there now that we didn't use. Somebody hadn't found it.
What year was that?
That was 52. That was a nice pile. That was one of the best.
Do you remember the
viewers? Yes, it was Mr. and Mrs. Robert Sigafoos. They were the
young fellow, but they was... It was one of the most congenial parties that I was ever out with. They was very nice. They were continually amazed at the things that could be done with an airplane, you know, and flying things around. Especially, they could work two or three different lakes on the same day and always get back to camp at night, you know. No, I don't think they do use them down there. They have been in Alaska one season before, but they'd have an airplane, a commercial airplane, just take them out on a lake. They didn't charge. They'd take them out on a lake and their gear, and they with instructions to come back on a certain day. Well, then that day would arrive, and they didn't dare leave camp. Plane would be 2-3 days, sometimes a week late getting back, or they'd hit 2 or 3 lakes and just located, restricted to just where they could walk around the lake, you know. They didn't get nowhere that year. This year they done, that year, 52, they done the whole Cobalt Valley. We went up to, we took in Walker Lake and Selby Lake. The two geologists, after they got the done down there around Shungnak, they had two full boats, so I would fly them up to the head of the tributary rivers on the north side, like the Reed and the Manivik, and 2 or 3 other rivers, the Ambler and the Hunt. And I would land in the last place that I could land in up there. But I couldn't take out a load, you know, and I'd be lucky to get out empty, which I was, you know, and did. And then they'd come down the river. It'd be a week coming down to the main Cobalt, and I'd pick them up from the Cobalt and bring them in camp. But in the meantime, every other day, and sometimes every day, I would, it wasn't called for, they didn't ask for it, but I would fly up and locate them and check on them, you know, and I would drop fresh supplies to them, which they was, on them trips they were living on sea rations, which wasn't too good, you know. They didn't go for that very well either, they get tiresome. But I would take them up fresh food, drop it down to them, they'd find it every time. Sometimes the tomatoes would get mashed up, but a loaf of bread would get split open.
No one was telling me about the dropping egg.
Mm-hmm.
That
kind of problem. Yeah, but they do it. Roll up the mattress. Just in the winter, they drop them in the snowbank as they can. But I guess I've never heard any complaints. I've dropped eggs that way for them with some of these camps, you know. Especially when they're building the highway from here to stateside across the border. I dropped eggs from them there, and I dropped frozen meat. I had 3 camps I dropped frozen meat to 3 times a week. I dropped one front quarter of beef on the frozen front quarter onto a tent. It was a drafting tent. And the bottom of the tent flew up in the air, and the top went down and to the ground, and they said they lost about $1,200 of instruments there. It was ruined, jammed up into their own fault. They were going to mark out a bullseye for me. And they went and pitched a camp between a lake and the river, bend in the river. They were on the riverbank. They didn't mark out no place. The only place I could drop was a spot about big as this lot between this lake and the river. And the last time around, I dropped in 4 or 5 pieces of meat at a time, and heavy pieces, you know. And the last time around, we had this front quarter to drop. And it was raining, the ceiling was low, that didn't help any. And I had a Johnson boy now, George Johnson, very good at it. And I yelled at him to drop, and he shoved this quarter of beef out the door, the Stinson going. And a rope around it caught onto the handle. He held the door about that far open, laying side edging off sideways. It didn't drop. Well, then we was out over the river. very nice. I found the plane would fly, so I told him not to cut it. We'd go around, and then he could cut the rope when it came over the tent, over the camp. The others we dropped in front of the tents, all right, but this time we got fouled up, you see. And I told him the door open and made the plane fly kind of sideways. So I allowed for that drift, but I allowed not quite enough. No, I overcompensated. That is it. I overcompensated a little bit. He was coming down in front of the tent. He'd come right down on top of this grass in the tent. Boy, I saw the canvas go billowing up in the air out of the corner of my eye. But anyway, they got the meat. Then one of the other camps at Tope. That was solid timber, you know, and an open place with willows out back. They were going to make a boat ride, too, out behind the camp. They put the camp in this solid timber. And then the place where they wanted me to drop, they didn't get around to put this bullseye out there. They didn't cut the willows, and the willows were just as thick as hair and on the back. So I come around there, I thought George Johnson was there again, too, and it was just about ready to drop these willows, and I looked down there, and here was a man's face looking up at us, right out of every willow bush. So I yelled him to hold it. He held it and we went around again. Give him time to get out of the way. And then we come around him and we dropped him. Oh, 8 or 10 pieces of beef in that. Well, I didn't think anybody would ever find it. But they told me afterwards they found every piece of it. They had 35 men there on fire. And a couple of dogs.
Well, how do you gauge yourself when you're dropping something like that?
Well, you drop at low altitude, and what's right straight under you, that's where the fire's going to hit. You don't have no sights or nothing, you know. You don't dive bomb it. You just fly around looking straight down, and when you get over that spot where you just yell down to cut, and it'll fall right there. Another place down at Calf Eaton Rapids I dropped there. There was another camp there that I dropped two places. And they had a heavy moss, and they were right on the bank of the river. They had a bullseye. So I got all the pieces but one right into that bullseye, but they said there was one piece missing. You dropped it in the river. They were pretty excited about that. And I know darn well it didn't go in the river and told them so, but they insisted that it did. And a week later, they found it. It had gone under the moss, and it went over 300 feet under that moss, right between the ground and the moss, in the swamp, you know. Right along, it struck the frozen ground under the moss, and the skeeter ran along. And it was a dog that found it, and it started smelling. So then they apologized. It hit the bullseye, all right, but it went under the moss, and the skeeter ran along. I was 2 years down on the peninsula down there, Platinum and Fort Hyde and Fort Mahler. And the bears were picked. We were in amongst the bears every day. And we see from 5 to 15 and then big old falls and everything. You know. They didn't bother us much.
They claim that if you stand still, they won't attack you.
Well, they go even further than that. Brownies are not as vicious as the grizzlies. The grizzlies are the ones that are unpredictable, but them brownies, if you don't mess around with them, they won't buy you. Put a camp on Black Lake. Went over there with some of the gear and one man and a float plane and land on the lake and then find a place for the camp. And there was three of them big brownies right on the beach. Where we wanted to beach plane. So I went down and bugged them and got them off the beach. And they went up on a little bench there, 100 yards away, and stood there and watched us. All I had in the plane was a .22 rifle. An emergency gun, not at all, not to shoot bears. And we beached the plane and unloaded it. I left the man there, and he pitched the camp, out of the camp anyway, and bears stayed stayed up there on the bench and watched him for 2-3 hours before they wandered away. Didn't bother him at all.
No, I saw a picture showing it to you a while back. So it means that they wouldn't attack us. The guy down here stopped me.
They
stood right there and took pictures of him. He made several false starts. You know, I mean, he kept stalking like he was going to. But when they didn't move, I finally changed his mind and I walked out.
Yeah, they're more or less like a good natured, you know, until you make some of the hostile move at them, and then, of course, you start one of them, you get one of them mad, and he'll fight to the bitter finish. There's more of us down there. They had two light keepers out on the, in the tundra. They put them out there with a weasel. And I had some men over on a lake beyond them, and I used to go right by their camp. I go over there, all these lightkeepers. They have so much bad weather, they can't work, you know, and they just get in the habit of sleeping, and they sleep the clock around, you know. And one morning early, I was going over there to supply these men on the lake, and as I went across their camp in the tundra there, there was a great big brown bear just smelling around the tent. Right at the tent, too, you know. So I went down and I buzzed him away from that, chased him over the mountain. And I did everything but blow the tent down before I got him started, you know. And a few days later, they got the work done, and we went out and brought him in to Fort Hyden. They didn't even know I'd been there.
They didn't even hear the plane.
Nope. Didn't know nothing about it. Didn't know it had been a bear out or anything.
Kind of sound sleeping.
And there was two other guys, I had them on a lake, and they had a light up on the mountain about a mile up the mountain, you know. And they went up there, they tend them lights at night when there's the least light, you know, for the observing parties. They shine up better, they can't hardly get them in the daytime. And they went up there onto the mountain. They had the light already up there. And just as they got up there on top of the mountain, a bear came up on the mountain, a big bear. And they had on raincoats and rubber boots and coveralls, and they were dressed to stand around this light, you know. It would be pretty cold standing around the light. So they see this bear, and he just walked right up pretty close to them, and they started running. The bear took after them. They got about halfway down the mountain, and one guy, he just petered out. He just couldn't go any further without taking off them rubber boots and some of his coats, sweaters. So he sat down to kick out his rubber boots, and the bear sat down. And he took off his rubber boots and his sweater and raincoat. The bear sat there and watched him. And when he got him off, he got up and started running again. The bear took after him again. They got out of the lake, and the tent was pitched right beside the lake, of course. So instead of going into the tent, they run out in the water. The bear came and sat down on the shore. And he kept them in the water so long that they were in the water up to their waist, you know. He didn't even come out to get them. If he'd wanted them, he could have come out and got them, you know. One of them, his leg wouldn't hold him up anymore. The other one was holding him up. About that time, one of the planes came along and chased the bear away. Got him out of the water.
You think that he got wise there when the bear
said that? Yeah, you think so, but then I suppose they were so terrified and kind of panicky, you know.
What was the purpose of his life?
They put him up on a surrounding quadrangle, you know, and then they have an observing party here and there to shoot on the light. That was precise triangulation, you know, putting in control points for other surveys. I had a good many years of that.
You ever have any bad times when you're forced down or anything?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them things happen, you know. Weather gets bad.
I've been principally
Any damage, anything like that, much I didn't have to use much ingenuity to keep going. We were, of course, flying floats a lot, you know, in the summer, and usually there's some water around there, even landed in the mud, and didn't do no harm at all, you know.
Landed in the mud on floats?
Yeah. And at Dillingham, we had a mud bar there behind the docks, you know, reached out into water. Well, at low tide, probably 75 or 100 yards. And we taxi up in that mud and right up to the beach. Turn the ship around, put in the load, and taxi out through the mud into the water again. 75 or 100 yards. And lots of places, lots of lakes I landed in. As soon as the boats come off, as soon as the plane come off the step, why, it was in the mud, you know. But if it's slippery mud, it's all right. But if it's sand, and then you go on your back, so you gotta know what kind of a bottom it's got. You gotta be able to tell that landing in the shallow lake. I went out in the blueberry bushes one time. Commander Stewart, you had a small lake you wanted to go in to, and told him I couldn't take off there unless I had a good wind from a certain direction. So one day the good wind come up, there was an important point that had to get there, you know. So one day that good wind come up and we went up there. While he was doing his work, the wind went down. And besides, it was evening and the light was poor and a little mist on the ocean, on the lake, you know. You couldn't tell. One time the grass would look 50 yards away and the next time it would look 3 feet away, and at the same time looking at it, you couldn't gauge distance at all. So I was trying to take off there. The third time I thought I had one float out of the water. And the grass looked further enough ahead, and I was going to lift the other float out, and at that time we hit the grass. Oh, we went out in the blueberry bushes, I guess about 400 or 500 feet. Didn't break nothing, didn't hurt the floats any either. It was grass and blueberry bushes and marshy